legislation criminalizing many protesters, a COVID relief debate in Washington, plus a nursing home visitation bill, and more on Indiana Week in Review for the week ending February 5th, 2021.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller. Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.
This week, legislation debated in a Senate committee would turn almost anyone who participates in a protest that turns violent into criminals. Republican Senator Mike Young's legislation is aimed at last summer's Black Lives Matter protest in Indianapolis. Among the bill's provisions is making violating curfew a Class B misdemeanor, which could be up to 180 days in jail. It also says that if anyone at a riot is killed, all of the rioters could be charged with felony murder. And if a protest turns violent, anyone at the protest can be charged with a Class B misdemeanor unless they immediately leave or alert police, whether or not they were involved in the violence. Indiana Public Defender Counsel's Michael Moore says the bill casts too wide a net around people at protests.
I make them criminal when in fact they were just bystanders committing no criminal act, just happen to be witness an act or be in the presence.
The Indiana Prosecuting Attorney's Council and the Hoosier State Press Association also opposed the bill. The only group in support was the Fraternal Order of Police, represented by Ed Merchant.
It's common sense. It's needed. It's needed years ago, and it's even more necessary today.
The bill will undergo changes in the coming weeks, but it's unclear what those changes will mean. Does the protesters' bill go too far? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwannis, host of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly, State House reporter for the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting State House reporter Brandon Smith. Mike O'Brien, does this bill strike an appropriate balance?
I think it has the opportunity to. I don't think it's quite there yet. But I do think that this is necessary to clarify some of these things. Putting the teeth in the curfew that mayors and local officials don't currently have is valuable, and we saw that was valuable over the would have been useful over the summer. Expanding the Attorney General's ability of concurrent jurisdiction with prosecutors, they already have that for homicides. Expanding this to rioting is tricky. Because there's politics involved, it's subjective. What's an lawful assembly and what's a riot? What's a protest? Peaceful protest and a constitutional gathering. The part that where it goes off the rails and it makes it easy to demagogue is this idea that if you're at a protest and it in part becomes violent, that you are now potentially able to be charged with murder. I mean, take this off of Black Lives Matter for a minute. Put it on January 6th. I think the vast majority of those people that were at the Capitol in Washington, D.C., had no intention of committing violence and did not commit violence, but could have been charged with the murder of a Capitol police officer just because they were standing in the mall when it happened. So that clearly goes over the line, and it'll never be prosecuted because it'd be so hard for police and prosecutors to figure out, but it's also not a reason to put it in law either.
Yeah, that example actually of the Capitol insurrection was used in the committee. I think Senator Karen Talion raised that as an example, and the answer was yes, to your point, Mike O'Brien, that it's exactly what this bill would do in that circumstance. Ann Delaney, is there a kernel of a good bill in here, even if there's more that perhaps, as Mike said, goes off the rails a little bit?
You know, it's typical of Mike Young's legislation initiatives. It is poorly conceived and poorly drafted. And if you want to put a little teeth in the curfew violation, that's one thing. That can be done easily. Everything else is already taken care of by existing law. And the idea that the Attorney General would expand jurisdiction to be able to prosecute these cases is ridiculous. I mean, he doesn't have the manpower. He doesn't have the ability. He certainly doesn't have the background to do it. I understand that Mike Young's angry. I mean, that's clear. And he wants to lock up the people who made him angry. I wonder, though, as per Senator Talion's observation, I wonder if he was aware that when he proposed this, that many of his supporters, who I'm sure he's proposing this to cater to, would have been arrested in D.C. under these circumstances. It's impossibly broad. It redoes the bail system in addition, and changes the reason for bail under this statute. It is just, you know, all right, I get that he's angry, tough. Nobody wanted that riot. It shouldn't have happened. I understand that. And if you want to expand curfew violations to make it some kind of a class misdemeanor or at least an infraction, that's one thing. Everything else is extraneous and poorly drafted.
Nikki Kelly, we've seen more than a few pieces of legislation this year, not just filed, but also moving, that respond to a lot of what happened last year, whether it was with COVID-19 or the protests seen around Indiana and around the country. Given that clear mood among the legislature, do you see this bill going even all the way?
You know, I think this is kind of natural when something happens like this, that lawmakers just want to do something, so they, you know, maybe overreact a little. I mean, I honestly don't understand. I think this is one of those situations where we already have the laws on the books. Like, if someone breaks a window and sets a place on fire, you arrest them for that. You know, if someone beats someone up or graffiti, we have laws for that. This idea that if I'm across another street and can get in trouble for that, I don't know how that passes sort of Indiana's criminal justice system and the knowing and intentional element that we have to prove of all crimes.
John Schwann.
Well, the one point, I'm sorry to insert myself real quick, but that was part of the frustration here is that the Marion County prosecutor announced while those riots were happening that they would not be prosecuted on the back end of that. And that's, I think that's fueling part of this frustration. You're right, there are laws, but they're not being prosecuted.
But wait just a second, Michael. How do you identify the people? Okay. I mean,
we're doing it right now. we're pulling people out of Johnson County who are in Washington, D.C., storming the Capitol. Yep. Tell me
they were on video. And that was right. What makes it easy. Those people were so arrogant, they filmed themselves.
You
can't tell me there wasn't evidence that you could have gone and found some of those people.
I saw lots of videos.
Committing damage.
That.
There's a ton of video.
Breaking the windows with people you could identify. With people you could identify.
I have a camera in the lobby of my office that was ransacked. I'm sure we could have pulled the video and sent it to the prosecutor if we wanted to.
Well, you should have.
Well, he said he wasn't going to prosecute anybody. That's why we have this.
That's
why this is being expanded, so the attorney general's concurrent jurisdiction. That's the motivation for it. And it's a direct
reaction. That's a big part of it.
Riot is about to break out here on set.
All right.
It's peaceful.
It's
also peaceful.
Let's move on. Indiana U.S. Senator Todd Young was among 10 Republicans who met with President Joe Biden for 2 hours this week in an effort to negotiate the next round of COVID-19 economic relief. The dollar amount of direct payments to Americans is one of the areas where Senator Young differs with President Biden. The Biden administration wants to issue $1,400 checks. Senator Young wants that number to be $1,000 and restricted to people at a much lower income than previous relief packages. Young says he hopes whatever the deal is, that it's bipartisan.
The process of working together to develop these solutions, I think, can help unify not just our leadership, but also our country.
Young says he agrees with President Biden that the next round of stimulus funds should include money to get vaccines to states more efficiently and get students back into the classroom. And Delaney, the 10 GOP senators want more targeted relief payments to individuals. Are they right?
Well, I think President Biden has already indicated that they're willing to negotiate on that point to lower the ceiling on who would receive that. And, you know, I think this is to Todd Young's credit that he's A, went to the meeting, and B, called out Marjorie Greene on her absolutely, as he put it, loony ideas.
Nutty.
Thank you.
Nutty. He used both terms.
Same idea. But I think he's the only one, certainly the only federal Indiana elected official that's on the Republican side that's acting with integrity. He's trying to do the right thing, both in certifying Joe Biden's election and now in working with Joe Biden in the middle of a pandemic. And I think that's good. And the president has indicated a willingness to deal and negotiate on what that threshold would be and what the ceiling would be for those payments. I don't think that's going to be a problem. So I'm hoping that he and the other nine will support this legislation, because it's necessary to get us out of this economic recession that we're in as a result of the pandemic.
Well, the Senate took a big step forward already later this week, in the last few hours, in fact, in moving forward the budget resolution that will get this relief package out to the public. It was by a 51-50 vote. No Democrats broke ranks, neither did Republicans. They split evenly, with Vice President Kamala Harris breaking the tie. Mike O'Brien, to Todd Young's point about, you know, a show of unity in working in a bipartisan basis on this relief package, are Hoosiers who vote both for Democrats and Republicans going to care what the vote was in Congress if they get these payments?
No, I don't think so. I think Ann's right. I think Senator Young has handled this. I think he's striking exactly the right tone. I think the state and the country are hungry for this kind of cooperation, in the context of COVID and other places. I think there's a deal. We're all agreeing. It's just, where's the line? This idea that we're just going to shotgun money out to people again is ridiculous. We know that well-educated people, if you have a college degree, your unemployment rate is 2%, or it's right around there. It's really low, and you're likely to make a better than average income, $60,000, $70,000, $80,000 a year. You should not get a stimulus check just because you had to do it from home. There are people who are really hurting, particularly in the service industry and people on the lower end of the economic ladder that need direct relief, and Todd Young is right on in helping them first.
All right. Let's move on. Time now for viewer feedback. Each week, we pose an unscientific online poll question in conjunction with our Ice Miller email and text alerts. This week's question, how much should the next round of COVID relief checks be? $1,400, more than that, or less than that? Last week, we asked you if Libertarian governor and U.S. Senate candidates should have to get 4,500 voter signatures to get on the ballot, the same way Democrat and Republican candidates do. 67% of you say yes, they should, while 33% say no. I can tell you the bill that would have done that looks like it's died this session. But if you'd like to take part in the poll, go to WFYI.org/IWIR and look for the poll. Well, Indiana would require all nursing homes to allow at least some limited visitation for their residents, even during a pandemic, under legislation unanimously approved by a Senate committee this week. The bill proposes creation of an essential family caregiver program. Indiana nursing homes cut off visitation during the pandemic, leaving many Hoosiers isolated from their families. Vicki Ayers' mother was one of them. She died late last year after Ayers says she deteriorated in isolation at a nursing home.
It is too late for my mom. But you can make a difference in the lives of thousands of people by requiring essential family caregivers access into the homes where their loved ones are waiting.
Legislation would require nursing homes to allow designated family members access even under emergency order lockdowns following federal government guidelines. Ayers notes those family members would still have to take precautions.
If staff can come and go, tested, screened, and with proper PPE, an essential family caregiver can do exactly the same thing and pose no additional risk to the residents or staff.
The bill heads to the full Senate. John Schwannis, how much are lawmakers going to be willing to dictate something like this to nursing homes?
Nursing homes enjoy traditionally a lot of clout with the Indiana General Assembly, and that was especially true when some of the most prominent members of the General Assembly were owners of nursing homes. There has been a strong alliance among owners of nursing homes and members of the General Assembly. Having said that, probably the most tragic stories, and there are umpteen tragic stories every day that come out of COVID-19, but some of the most poignant are those stories we've all heard about nurses, doctors having to hold up a cell phone or a tablet so that an aging person with COVID-19 can say goodbye to a spouse or a loved one or a child because of requirements that they not be able to say goodbyes in person. Again, those are just heartrending. And I think the fact that this came out of committee on the unanimous vote gives a good indication of just how those types of stories have touched everybody, including members of the General Assembly. And I think they would see this as not an altogether onerous requirement during this crisis period.
Yeah, Nikki Kelly, John is absolutely right, of course, in that the nursing home industry has enjoyed generally a lot of cloud at the State House the last several years, but there's a brighter light being shown on nursing homes right now, in large part as a result of COVID, but overall than there has been, at least as far as I can remember. Is that partly why we're seeing measures like this not just pass, but pass unanimously?
Yeah, I mean, I think there have been some issues that, you know, we've had a very high death rate in our nursing homes and even higher than some of the other states. So I think people are looking to find ways. And I'm, you know, when John mentioned people having to say goodbye like that, I heard even different stories, whereas it wasn't so much about anyone who was sick in there. It was people who were on separate units who literally hadn't been out of their room in months because the staff are overwhelmed, obviously, with caring, but, you know, they don't get any interaction, any human contact. And that can be just draining.
Yeah, we heard Vicki Ayers, who testified in the committee, talked about the nursing home where her mother was, wouldn't even allow closed window visits. So Vicki wanted to stand outside the building, outside the window, the closed window, and just, you know, see her mother through the window. They wouldn't even allow that. So, again, the brighter light being shown. But, Mike O'Brien, I'll ask you this. Is this the sort of thing that the legislature should be dictating to nursing homes?
Pretty extraordinary reaction, a pretty extraordinary set of circumstances. So to set, and for nursing homes, I don't know the nursing home generally their position on any of this, but they may appreciate guidance on what's safe and what's not. Can you stand outside of the window? Probably the answer is probably yes. Look, I think we're going to put this type of issue, and there's going to be a lot of examples of the reaction to COVID 10 months ago and how we got it wrong and how we were unthoughtful about it or weren't thoughtful about it. And compassionate about it while we were trying to stem a exploding pandemic, and fair enough. But time to get some of these revisit some of these decisions and get them right and fix where we can.
We often talk on this show about a legislation you want it to be balanced, and this bill doesn't just say, well, they have to let anybody in. You could only designate two of these family caregivers. The bill says to be a family caregiver under this policy, you have to have been engaging in some way before any lockdown with that resident at least two times a week. This is not somebody who just randomly wants to show up. Does this bill, Ann Delaney, strike that right balance?
I think this bill is an overstep by the General Assembly. I'd rather see them spend their time talking about staffing at nursing homes and talking about safety at nursing homes and talking about how, as Mike says, we got it wrong. And we did get it wrong because too many people died from COVID in nursing homes. Nobody wants to see those kind of heart-wrenching stories that John referenced. And I know how hard those can be. But what we need to do is to concentrate. For example, in Nikki's idea about the isolation is absolutely right. But that's in part because the staffing is so poor at these places. And if we could look at that and make intelligent decisions about what is required in a certified nursing home in Indiana, I think the entire nursing home population and the public would be much better served than have the General Assembly micromanage in this one particular instance.
All right. Well, the House Public Health Committee advanced a bill this week that would raise the state cigarette tax for the first time in more than a decade while imposing a new tax on vaping products. Indiana hasn't raised its cigarette tax in over a decade, and American Cancer Society's Brian Hannon says numerous studies show raising the price helps people quit smoking.
So people want to quit smoking. They need some help to do it.
Indiana has one of the worst smoking rates in the country. The bill would also impose a tax on e-liquids for the first time, used in e-cigarettes. Vaping manufacturers and sellers like Mason Odell strongly oppose such a tax. He argues e-cigarettes help people quit smoking.
If you're going to tax e-liquid, you should be looking at Nicorette gum as well.
While some studies show that vaping products do help people reduce cigarette use, their effectiveness as a smoking cessation tool and whether vaping has its own serious health consequences are inconclusive. Nikki Kelly, the vote on this bill out of the House Public Health Committee at the end of the week was not unanimous, but it had nothing to do with the core policy of raising the tax, right?
Yeah, I mean, everyone supported that part. The question was, where does the money go? And the way the bill was written, 56% went to the general fund. And, you know, might some of that find its way to health issues? Maybe, but there was no saying it would. I mean, some of it was even going to pension relief.
John Schwanis, is this the best chance we've seen since 2007 for a raise of the cigarette tax?
Oh, I think so. And it's not for lack of effort that it hasn't prevailed before, because you've had large coalitions of very prominent, very powerful organizations, large employers. You've had the Chamber of Commerce. Lots of people come together on this in the past with well-funded campaigns. This time, I think it is very likely to happen for any number of reasons, including that the COVID-19, the pandemic showed just how poorly prepared Indiana was in terms of the health of its citizens. And we paid a price because of it. So this is that odd tax that if everything goes well and it accomplishes its mission, that revenue stream dries up by definition. So it's a bit of an odd That's duck.
Mike O'Brien, I was caught a little by surprise. At the end of this week, we talked to Speaker Todd Houston. One of the questions asked to him about this bill was whether at some point we might see the two taxes sort of split into two different bills, cigarette tax increase and then this vaping tax. And he said, he indicated, it seemed to me, that the vaping tax was almost a lock to pass, at least, I guess, out of the House. Are you surprised that that would be the one that has more support at this point?
No, because I think it's viewed by legislators that there's it's unequal right now. There's no tax on vape, but there is a tax on combustible cigarettes. So I'm not surprised by that. In terms of Nikki's point, where the money goes, the legislature has long resisted dedicated funding from certain sources. One big exception to that is the gas tax. It goes directly to roads, and maybe this is a good example of how it ought to go to health.
And Delaney, on that point, the House Public Health Committee did move more of the cigarette tax increase funding into Medicaid, paying off Medicaid obligations. Is that the right way to use that money?
You know, we're 49th out of the 50 states in public health funding. We have more pre-existing conditions. We have more people in nursing homes as a result of this, and more people at risk. If we could target this money, and I frankly don't think that this tax increase is enough. I think it ought to be more, and it ought to go right into public health, not into budget concerns, but into public health education and identification early, and dealing with diabetes and dealing with smoking and dealing with congestive heart failure. I mean, if we could do that, if we could put a substantial amount of money, we could make the population healthier. And then the next time a pandemic comes, and there will be another pandemic, we won't be so at risk with it. But it's so short-sighted on the part of the whole administration not to understand that a dollar invested in this is $10 we're going to save down the line.
All right. Well, most teachers and students won't have to quarantine anymore after a positive COVID-19 case in the classroom. That's according to new guidance from the Indiana Department of Health. State Health Commissioner Dr. Chris Box says data suggests spread of the virus is rare in classrooms when everyone is wearing a mask.
We will no longer require quarantine or contact tracing if the students and teachers remain at least 3 feet apart and are wearing a mask at all times in just the classroom.
Box emphasizes the new guidance only applies to the classroom.
It does not apply to lunch, athletics, band, orchestra, choir, or any other school setting where students may gather.
Box says the new guidance takes effect Monday. And Delaney, parents will undoubtedly be thrilled with this change, but will teachers?
I don't think so. I mean, I understand the controversy between whether the vaccine goes to elderly before it goes to teachers, but it seems to me when we have teachers teaching in person and risk spreading it through the children, through the parents and the grandparents that way, I think when we're asking the teachers to go back in under circumstances that don't meet the federal guidelines, 3 feet is not what the federal government says. It seems to me we ought to provide vaccine. We ought to have them roll up right to the schools and give the teachers the vaccination, and then we wouldn't have to worry about it and they wouldn't have to feel at risk.
Yeah, Mike O'Brien, to Ann's point exactly, this new policy, or this new guidance, I should say, it's not a mandate, but this new guidance isn't done in isolation in the sense that we are also at the same time having this debate over whether or not teachers should be prioritized for vaccines. So would it be less controversial, essentially, this new guidance, if teachers were eligible to get the vaccine?
Yeah, and I think once we get past the 65 and over category, they should be prioritized. This is 80 to 90% of the quarantines are coming out of the classroom in the big districts around Indianapolis, anyway. And so it's going to make a big difference. And it's going to put these kids back in the classroom. But I also want to add this. I think this fits in with the nursing home conversation. What do we know now that we didn't know 6 months ago? Well, we know that the transmission rate is very low in classrooms when you're conducting yourself safely, and this is a reflection of that understanding.
All right. Well, let's everybody keep our fingers crossed until that vaccine is widely available for everybody, which can't come soon enough. That is Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwannis of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly of the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at WFYI.org/IWIR, or starting Monday, you can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity and on the WFYI app. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Stay safe, stay healthy, please wear a mask, and join us next time, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller. Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com. The opinions expressed are solely those of the panelists. Indiana Week in Review is a WFYI production in association with Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.